I'm surprised you haven't heard about me. You know, I got a bad reputation. I mean, sometimes I just go nuts like now. Don't move. I'll make a deal with you, Arjun. Arjun, is that Ararian or whatever the fuck your name is? I'll make a little deal with you. You fold up your tents and get the fuck out of my country, and I won't do anything to you. I'll leave you alone. Because if you stick around here, I'm gonna fuck your ass. I'm gonna send you home with your balls in a sling. You got that?
Just get out of here, Kaffir lover.
Eenie, meenie, miney.
Aim up!
Andrew, I have an important question for you. First question of the night.
Yes.
Which was a better aquarium shootout, Lethal Weapon 2 or Mission Impossible? And you know what scene in Mission Impossible I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I do. It's it was when Ethan is meeting with Kittredge and he throws yes. Honestly, I kind of think Lethal just because it was so unexpected. And with Mission, you kind of knew that, like, he's got to get out of there. He's going to do something. So both were surprises, but I kind of have to go with Lethal on this one.
They're both like iconic scenes in both of their films, right?
Yeah.
Kittredge, you've never seen the upset. It's pretty fantastic.
Well, but remember though, that was an escape versus in this one, they're all trying to save the fish. So that was the nice thing about it. It was just kind of a nice FU from Riggs.
Before we kick things off, can we just talk about for a second how cool it was that Lethal Weapon 2 opens with the Looney Tunes music? I mean, like, I don't know who decided that, if that's Richard Donner or if that's somebody else, but like, it was their way of saying, like, we know this movie is going to be good. We know it's great. We know you're going to enjoy it. And let's go set the tone, like, right out of the gate. Isn't it awesome?
It was one of those things. It's like, okay, wait, what am I getting myself into? And then you're just immediately along for the ride.
You just don't see, like, most movies that come out just don't do that. They don't make creative decisions like that, at least not anymore. Maybe in the 80s, that was something that maybe was a little bit more common. I don't really feel like it ever was, but I love that that's how Lethal Weapon 2 starts. What I also love, there are episodes that I do where I'm talking with people that I've known for many, many years. And then I also have episodes where decades even. And I also have episodes where I'm talking to somebody that I barely know. And you are one of those people. You're one of the latter, just like our last guest, Jason Zolin, who I don't know very long either. You and I have known each other, I don't know, keep me honest here, a year, year and a half,
I think it's maybe a year, if that.
So let me set the stage of this and how you and I came to be tonight. I want to say this was like 9 months ago, give or take, might have been longer. And I remember you and I had a client dinner and we were meeting up at Casa Madera in West Hollywood. At the time, Andrew, hot place to get a reservation. So you must have had some pull. And I remember I was coming from another event. We had another client event that same night. So I was racing across town to meet up with you guys. I think we were running late. So I was the first one there. I got to the bar and you guys were already there having a drink or two. I walk up to the bar and literally the very first thing you said to me was, I'm pretty sure, it was like, dude, I need to be on your podcast. Like, I don't even know if you even said hello. You just went like right there. Do you remember this?
I do, like it was yesterday, because I have to give two shout outs to the LinkedIn algorithm, because I literally get served this this notification from you about your Roadhouse episode. I was like, wait, what's going on here? What is this all about? And I was like, oh my God. Like, now, Dennis, who I've literally, like, you and I had only maybe emailed. There was maybe one phone call before that time. And I was like, okay, I don't know Dennis, but he's really speaking my language, right? Right, just immediately. And I was like, okay, like, I started to do a little bit of a deep dive. I'm like, this is unbelievable. And I remember I said to you specifically, I'm like, Big Trouble in Little China. You're like, all right, well, I kind of covered off on it earlier, but you know, I was like, when can I be on? What can we do? And we just, you know, it was like, we were there for the rest of the night.
I actually was going to just ask you, what was the movie that you pitched me on? Because I knew that I said no, but I knew I had a reason for it. And I was going to say it was The Rock, but it wasn't The Rock because there's somebody else that wants me to do The Rock. Mike Fisher wants me to do The Rock. So it was Big Trouble. And we had just done that because we had done the Good Bad Movies episode. And Big Trouble was referenced a little bit in that episode. So I was like, can't really do Big Trouble in Little China.
Which I still stand by is one of the greatest, most fantastical, insane movies of all time.
But by the end of that dinner, I kind of feel like we had a short list of movies. And when you and it was like halfway through the meal when you actually I think we kept throwing out like, what about this? What about that? And I think you had mentioned maybe Jerry Maguire and some other stuff got referenced. But then you said Lethal Weapon 2. And that got my attention. And I think I might have like put my fork down. I was like, wait, talk about that. Talk to me about Lethal Weapon 2. Are you serious? And you were like, I'm very serious. And I think that was it. I think we may have had like a handshake deal by the end of the meal, right?
The funny thing about it was Eileen, you know, our friend and colleague, she said to me, she's like, I felt like I was on a mandate between the two of you. and big shout out to her because, you know, that was really the impetus because she and I were supposed to have dinner. And then she's like, oh, you know, clients want to come. Oh, Dennis wants to come. I'm like, okay. And then from there, it was like amazing. But yeah, we really had a shorthand for everything we were going through that night. I mean, just 80s, 90s, the aughts, classics. I mean, we were there. And I think we were kind of scaring each other with the deep cuts and the knowledge. So it was like, oh my God, all right, we are very much on the same page.
I've been circling this one for a really long time. And you and I both go to the same gym. We both go to Equinox. So we see each other at the gym pretty much every weekend. And we talk about how we're going to approach this episode. So I feel like this one has been highly anticipated by both of us. So everybody, tonight we're doing Lethal Weapon 2 from 1989, directed by the late filmmaker Richard Donner. Tonight's guest is my good buddy, Andrew Fryer. Andrew, give us the specifics. What do people need to know? Go.
I'm the rare LA native, actually third generation, which is a little insane in these parts because everybody, you know, seems to come here and they're like, wait, you're from here? So yeah, I grew up in the lovely San Fernando Valley. Still have the 818 cell phone number. I was really fortunate. I was exposed to the entertainment industry at a very young age. I had a grandfather who was a publicist during the golden age of Hollywood. Two uncles that are writers, and I just was a student of pop culture. I mean, to the point of pouring through the LA Times calendar section every Sunday, the TV guide. Just, I was always so excited when they would have their annual movie release issue, and then the fall TV preview. It was just one of those things that always kept me really excited, and that led to a career in digital advertising, which is how we got connected. But I'm also a writer. Been writing for about 10 plus years. Some articles. I have a book on Amazon. My shameless plug is it's called Hollywood's a Bitch. It's satirical fiction about a guy who works at a famous talent agency for pets. So, you know, that's my one little plug. But yeah, I mean, so. And movies and TV are still just very near and dear to my heart to the point of I see as much as I can, consume as much as I can.
I think Eileen was onto something when she set us up because I think she recognized that pretty quickly that you and I do indeed speak the same language. And it's funny, you and I grabbed beers a couple months ago, maybe at the beginning of the new year. And it wasn't that long ago. We hooked up and it was only then when you started telling me more about your creative background. And like, I didn't even know all of that about you. I knew you were into film and all that. That was obvious. But at the dinner that night, I don't think we got into that part of it. You're writing and you've been published and you're working on screenplays. And I think we only scratched the surface at the dinner. And then I really fully got what you were about.
The feeling was very mutual. We definitely, you know, it was better than just a couple of drinks, a nice dinner, and then just seeing each other in between reps at the gym. So I agree.
Lethal Weapon 2 is a very specific, very solid choice. Like, you had my respect ASAP when you threw that out. And it's the first sequel we have formally covered on this pod. I mean, I did reference Halloween 2 a few months back when I talked to Rick Rosenthal, but I don't count that. So Lethal Weapon 2, richly deserved. Why Lethal Weapon 2? Tell me why that was on your shortlist.
Lethal is one of those movies that, you know, is they always always define a movie where you can just kind of drop in at any moment and you're just going to get sucked in. It's one of those movies that you're going to laugh, you might have a cry, You're going to be just captivated by the action, great writing, quippy one-liners. And it's something that has just stayed with me, I would say, since childhood. I actually saw it before Lethal One.
Interesting.
Which doesn't always happen. I mean, you know, I can age myself. I was 11 years old. But I think that there was a – actually, I'll never forget my father telling me about the torture scene in Lethal One and how he thought that wasn't quite okay. But then when I saw it after I saw two, I was like, no, this isn't that scary. So, yeah, it's just a movie that – I feel like is really the cornerstone of the franchise, and it's just constantly quotable and really invokes great memories, especially amongst friends and just people I talk to. It's really kind of withstood the test of time in that sense.
You know, and it's interesting that you chose like the second one, right? And I didn't know that you had seen the second one before the first one. I saw them sequentially. I've seen all of them sequentially, but I'm also a tad older than you. But I think like, Lethal Weapon 2 is just such an odd choice. Like you didn't choose Lethal Weapon. You didn't ask for Die Hard. You just said like, I want to do Lethal Weapon 2. And those of us that are in the cool school, we all know that Lethal Weapon 2 is just a cool as shit movie, right? It's just like the movie's got so much going for it. It's got so much confidence. It says a lot about you. And I mean this as a compliment. It says a lot about you that you chose Lethal Weapon 2.
I'm glad you were on board because it was like, okay, we're both in.
So I want to go back to the summer of 89 for a second. It's funny. I was just texting with my buddy Dave the other night about this. Like summer of 89 is literally one of the greatest summers of my life. Like I was a couple months away from starting college. I started at Maryland in that fall and I had just graduated high school and I had a few months to kill just to make a couple of bucks. I was working at the movie theater, which I've referenced before in other episodes with all my best friends. It was in my very first serious relationship that summer with a slightly older woman. Andrew, man, I had it going that summer. It was just great. I want to get into how Lethal Weapon 2 first crossed your path. I don't know if you saw it in the theater. You probably didn't see it in the theater. You were 11. I mean, did you or did you see it on home video for the first time?
So I actually did see it in the theater.
You did?
I did. And it was one of the last movies that I saw with my parents before they got divorced.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it definitely has meaning for me. But, you know, to your point about earlier with the Looney Tunes opening, we go right to the car chase. I was just like, again, you're this full of life 11-year-old boy and you see the cops and robbers immediately. You're like, okay, I'm in. I was just sucked in. So in the theaters with the folks. And then the funny part about it was, do you remember those days when the hotels had the pay-per-view where you could watch for like maybe a minute before you would get charged?
Correct.
Like you could get the preview.
Yeah.
So we were on vacation. My sister and I saw that it was on. We had the bright idea that we would watch for a minute. We would then change the channel to a non-pay channel and then go back. We would do that back and forth thinking that we were gaming the system. And we did that a couple times over the course of wherever we were. And then when our parents were checking out and they get, you know, notified about five different charges.
Oh.
We're like, what's going on here? And thankfully it all got wiped off the bill. Like they claimed it was an accident and you know, that the staff was very kind and nobody was grounded, which was very, very much appreciated. But then the other thing, which I'm sure you also remember, was Columbia House used to have their movie club.
Sure.
Where you could select, you know, however many, like 10 movies, you know, like as a first timer. And, oh, Lethal 2 was one of them, and that's actually how I saw Lethal 1, because we just got both. So I had both on VHS. And I feel like it was one of those movies that also was very foreshadowing, because my parents split up a few months later, and I look at how Riggs was effectively adopted by Murtaugh's family.
Yeah.
You know, my mom met my stepdad only a few months later, and they've been together ever since, and it's 30-plus years, and I feel like that's another reason why it has great meaning for me, is just because it was a precursor to my life and, you know, real gratitude for my mom and stepdad. So
I love the fact that they took you to a movie when you were 11 years old. And that is very similar to me. I grew up in a movie going family. And, you know, by the time I was at the age of like, you know, 12, 13, you know, my brother and sister are both off at college or working. So like there was a bit of an age gap between us. Right. So by that point, I think my parents were just kind of tired of the whole rated R thing. At least my dad was. And my dad was just like, well, I want to go see this movie. Let's go, you know, get your jacket. And he and I would go pretty much see anything. I mean, he took me to see Police Academy. He took me to see Lethal Weapon. you know, I think my mom took me to see Beverly Hills Cop when I was 13. And I'm not kidding. Like, you know, they took me to see Witness. Like, I saw all kinds of R movies. So, like, it didn't really matter. So I love the fact that you saw something at 11. I'm not sure if they took me to too many R movies at 11 years old. But, you know, Lethal's not that bad. I mean, it's got some violence, but whatever.
I will just say, and I think you recall, and I'm not going to get in too deep on it, but my mother, God bless her, I know she's going to listen, seeing RoboCop at age 7, not knowing what she was about to get into with two other 7-year-olds, and when he's getting blown to hell, her turning to us saying, do you guys want to leave? We're like, no, this is the greatest thing we've ever seen. That's a different story.
Dude, RoboCop, Paul Verhoeven, that is a hard, hard R. Hard.
Yes.
That movie is as violent as it gets for a rated R film. But let's go back to the summer of 89 for a second. I am curious, as an 11-year-old, I was 18. So as an 11-year-old, I mean, this summer, and I've talked about this on previous episodes, but the summer of 89, in my opinion, has got to be one of the top three best movie summers of my lifetime. I mean, just off the top of my head, Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. You had Batman, the first Batman from Tim Burton, Field of Dreams. You had Dead Poets Society, When Harry Met Sally, Do the Right Thing. You had The Abyss. I mean, I remember The Abyss played at the theater I was working at that summer, like a month before I went off to school. And, you know, August is usually the time of year where studios kind of dump some of the not so great movies that they don't think are going to play as well in June and July because they can't get the screens, but they can get the screens in early August, right? And that's when James Cameron's latest film after Aliens comes out, The Abyss, in early August. And that's like kind of what like ended the summer. But like, do you remember that summer when, as an 11-year-old, did you see a lot of movies? Were you going to the theater a lot back then?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those summers that when you just look at the blockbusters, the franchises, the, you know, recreation of the romantic comedy When Harry Met Sally, which I saw as I was – I don't think I saw it – like, I definitely didn't see it in theaters, but I saw it a little bit after. But I actually still have an Indiana Jones and Last Crusade frame poster in my childhood bedroom. Because that's how important all of those movies were, and especially Batman. And I still remember Batman really being that movie that came out with all of the merch and having such a huge impact on the consumer product side. So, yeah, I mean, to say it was a pivotal summer would be an understatement.
Man, I was like, as an 18-year-old movie theater usher at that summer, I was at that stage in my life where I already had a pretty major taste for entertainment marketing. And I had no idea at this point when I was about to go off to college that that was going to be a career of mine. I mean, I can't sit here and say that at 18 years old, I knew that this was the industry I was going to work in. I had no idea of that. But I did know that I was passionate and really interested in all things marketing, whether it be the posters in the theater, the cardboard standees in the theater. We had this little old school TV screen in our lobby, and they played the trailers on a loop. And I remember watching that stuff. And I remember that spring, it's funny, like Lethal Weapon 2, you got to remember back in 89, this is pre-internet, right? This is pre-social media. It's pre-YouTube. There's no trailer drops. There was no way of like finding out about a movie. The only way you found out about a movie coming out is if you saw the trailer in the theater, and they didn't play that many trailers back then like they do now. You had to read Premiere Magazine. You know, this is, I think, before Entertainment Weekly. I don't even think that existed yet. So like it was either trailers or TV spots or magazines. And I remember it was the spring of 89, and I was in the back of the theater. The lights came down, and all of a sudden, I don't remember what movie it was, but the trailer for Lethal Weapon 2 played. And my first reaction was like, what the fuck? They're making a second weapon. I didn't even know that they were making a second one. So like, but I remember the teaser trailer was the toilet bomb sequence. And it was a great trailer. I highly encourage everybody to go check it out on YouTube. But the original teaser trailer for Lethal Weapon 2 was basically a cut down version of the toilet bomb sequence at the Murtaugh home. And like, that was the entire trailer. They didn't show anything else. It was that. And I remember like they showed the toilet blow up, it goes out of the window and it lands on the station wagon. And I remember the narrator, he's like, you know, this time they're not taking any crap or whatever the line was, which was just a killer line. I was like just giddy. I was just giddy that Lethal Weapon 2 was coming. It was a great teaser. Do you remember like any of this? Or are you too young to?
I do.
Like,
and the fact that you're bringing it back is almost just giving me chills because I remember that, you know, they had the kind of very fun beat, score from Michael Kamen. It was just kind of like a nice tease, and it's the same exact trailer music that they used for Lethal 3, which I don't know if we're going to get into, but the same idea of just that kind of comedic folly, you know, was something that might not be that hilarious, but they happen to create it as a pretty funny moment.
Going back to what I said about not knowing that this movie was coming out, one of the reasons for that is that as we've done the research, you and I have both done our deep dive on this film, is that this movie was actually shot right down to the wire. And I didn't even know this back in 1989, that Lethal Weapon 2 like barely made its release date. And the reason why it barely made its release date is that they were, at the time, it had two different endings. And they were still trying to determine which way they were going to end this movie. One ending, you know, featured Riggs surviving, and the other ending, which we'll get into, was Riggs dying. And I guess because of the way they were shooting it, they needed all the sets. They had to keep all the sets for a lot longer of a period because they weren't quite sure how they were going to wrap it up yet. So that's why, I mean, I think this movie ended filming within like maybe 8 weeks before release.
Wow.
Don't hold me to that number, but I know that it was very, very late in the game when this film wrapped before the July release date. Pretty crazy to think, right?
I know there are always those countless stories about, oh, this didn't do as well in a test screening and, you know, we have to, you know, shuffle and shift here. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of crazy.
So let me ask you something before we break into this movie. Which character do you associate yourself more with? Is it Riggs? Are you a Riggs guy? Are you a Murtaugh guy? Hell, I'll even give you Leo Getz if you want to throw that one out there. Who are you most like?
Every boy wants to say that they're Riggs because he's fearless and he's out of his mind and he could do anything. But there's no chance in hell. I mean, I'm one of the most risk-averse people out there. So yeah, I mean, I would say it's definitely more Murtaugh. I appreciate Leo Getz's, you know, ability to kind of manipulate with his words, etc. But no, I mean, if I had to pick between the two, I mean, sure, we all would love to be Riggs in our own right outside of the demons. But yeah, I don't definitely envision myself hanging on the front grill of a tow truck.
Yeah, so. I can't say that I am Riggs either. I think there's a part of me that's like Riggs in that I do love dogs, as he does. But I also feel like there's a part of me that can be a loner at times. I wouldn't call myself a loner, but I do have loner tendencies. There are moments of my week or of my life where I like to be by myself for a little while, but not for long. But I do like, I'm comfortable being by myself for a little bit. So yes, I am very much more by the book, just like you are, very much leaning towards Roger. Plus, my dad's name was Roger, so that needs to count for something.
makes a lot of sense. You know, we're risk averse, but at the same time, it's the fantasy, like the, you know, just being very, you know, more of a cowboy. Great.
We had that same kind of conversation last month when Jason and I were talking about Swingers and how so many guys probably had a man crush on Vince Vaughn, right? And the character of Trent from that movie. And I would say that's probably not unlike the reaction that a lot of young men like you and I were about Martin Riggs, right? Like there was this guy, he had the badass hair and, you know, he's in great shape and he could fight and he could shoot great. And he was just like, he had a great sense of humor. He was just that great character that you sort of had a man crush on, right?
100%. And just, I mean, it was funny because the mullet was a little tighter in two and, you know, it was a little more free flowing in one. I actually think he had the same hairstyle in one and three, which I was like, wait, we're going a different direction here because it looked a little bit tighter in two versus one and three.
That was a great year for the mullet, right? Because you had Roadhouse, which came out a month or two before Lethal Weapon 2. Same producer, Joel Silver. And you had the great mane on Pat Sweezy. And then you had the same hairdo with Martin Riggs, with Mel Gibson. It's just that hairdo, man, it's not around anymore.
Well, long at last.
Yeah. Why didn't he plant the bomb in Trisha's stove?
Think of all the needless suffering could have ended right there.
Yeah. Gonna die on the toilet, honor.
Guys like you don't die on toilets. Anyway, I'm here and I'm not planning on going just now.
Okay. Let's do it.
Okay. On three. Oh, boy, let me get into the tub.
Okay.
Oh, I'm just going to give you the... On three, huh? What do you say?
Okay, yeah. Okay.
One. Two.
Wait.
What?
Do we do it on three or... do one, two, three, then do it?
Well, it's your ass, Cochise. I mean, it's up to you.
My ass, yeah. Three.
Well, we go on three.
Three on like three.
One, two, and nine.
Three.
Yeah.
Okay.
One.
What?
Yeah, no. two, three!
So let's talk about it. Lethal Weapon 2, directed by the late Richard Donner. I want to give Richard Donner his due. He's a really well-regarded and, in my opinion, a very talented filmmaker. And I know that you're a fan of a lot of his films. He passed away just a few years ago. It might have been during the early days of COVID. But I want to acknowledge a couple of the films that he directed. He directed The Omen, which was really his first big studio break. And he made that after the success of The Exorcist. And obviously, studios were eager to capitalize on horror movies. So he did The Omen, which ended up being the fifth highest grossing movie of 1976, which I did not know. Richard Donner directed the original Superman, and he directed Superman 2. He was fired from Superman 2. I guess he did not get along with the producers on set of that second film. So he started production for that, but he did not finish it. He directed Lady Hawk. He directed everybody's favorite movie, The Goonies, from 1985, which I don't think a lot of people realize that The Goonies was directed by the same guy that directed Lethal Weapon. He directed Scrooged with Bill Murray. And he also did a really wonderful little movie from the early 90s that I happen to love called Radio Flyer, which featured a really young Elijah Wood. Hard-hitting movie. Did you ever see that?
I've only seen bits and pieces, but I, you know, with my encyclopedic memory, I know that the brother was Joseph Mazzello, who nice. Was in Jurassic Park well and done. Was also in Social Network. And I want to say, was it Tom Hanks who had the cameo as the older version of Elijah Wood?
You are correct, my friend. Man, you're throwing fastballs right now. Well played. Well done.
Thank you. But I have no shame in saying that I haven't seen the whole thing, but I do remember it being a very kind of dark child abuse-ish story.
Never felt like he was one of those directors that was sort of a household name, you know, like a Spielberg or like a Scorsese and some of these other filmmakers are of his generation. Here's what Mel Gibson said about Richard Donner. Uncle Dick, he's a great guy, just terrific, extremely professional. He's an old veteran and has an understanding of film that is the culmination of years of experience. He's got the technical stuff down, his vision down. No matter what you say about Dick, it underrates him. He really loves what he's doing, loves working with actors, and he allows you freedom to explore all kinds of areas. He'd be like, all right, kid, he'll say, and slap you on the back and just let you try something. Because even if he doesn't know sometimes, he's just an extremely charming, talented, great fucking guy. I love him. That's Mel Gibson about Richard Donner. How do you feel about that? Wow.
Uncle Dick sums it all. It just is, you know, the guy you want to hang out with. I mean, he always had kind of that kind of dad presence. I mean, even just hearing about the stories on the set of Goonies. I mean, he really just made sure that all of those kids were just looked after and was always very professional. I feel like anything I've read has not been ill against him.
Lethal Weapon 2 was released on July 7th, 1989. I remember it came out like 2 weeks after Batman. That was a great couple weeks for Warner Brothers, man. They had Batman, to your point, at the end of June, which was just getting all kinds of fanfare. And then literally 2 weeks later, they released this movie out at the theaters. And I kind of feel like maybe Lethal Weapon 2 was sort of overshadowed by the bigness of Batman. And that movie had gotten such a huge marketing push that Lethal Weapon 2 was just sort of like under the radar. But man, and we'll get into this in a second, but the movie did quite well and it grossed a lot in 1989. Lethal Weapon 2 is based on original story by Shane Black, who wrote the original Lethal Weapon screenplay. But the story was by Shane Black and Warren Murphy. So I guess Lethal Weapon 2 was based on one of his original screenplays called Play Dirty. And in this version of the screenplay, Martin Riggs does die at the end. And I guess Warners and Richard Donner wanted a lot more levity in the sequel, which honestly, I'm glad they chose that because I think that's part of the movie's charm is the use of humor and heart and comedy that I think maybe weren't as prevalent in Lethal Weapon 1. So anyway, Jeffrey Boehm was brought on. This is the same guy that wrote Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. He was having a pretty good summer.
No small credits to hang your hat on. I mean, it's, you know, very casual talk at a cocktail hour. But he had a pretty phenomenal screenwriting career. Just looking at both of those, I was blown away.
And he also did one of my very favorite Chevy Chase movies. You probably know this, but he wrote the screenplay for Funny Farm. Are you all in on Funny Farm? Or are you down on Funny Farm?
I can't even believe I'm going to admit it. I still have never seen the thing all the way through. So
oh my
I know.
God.
I know. Really? I'm admitting it on this. Yes, as much of a Chevy fan as I am, I still have never seen it.
That's your homework, man. Go watch Funny Farm at some point between now and the end of the year. Okay, I'll give you some time. Just watch it. It's really good. Jeffrey Boehm wrote that screenplay. That movie came out a year before in 88. So anyway, he's brought on. It sounds like the screenplay changed pretty dramatically. The Stilt House, that was in the original screenplay, and it obviously made it to the final film. But besides the Stilt House, there weren't a lot of similarities. Leo Getz, who's played by Joe Pesci, was a minor character in Play Dirty, but here in Lethal Weapon 2, Jeffrey Boehm gave Joe Pesci something much bigger to work with, and Leo Getz became a big character. I mean, Andrew, let's talk about it now. Let's just get Leo Getz out of the way. But like, stroke of genius, in my opinion, that they elevated this small character and they made him sort of like the third lead in this movie. And Gibson and Glover already had amazing chemistry, but Joe Pesci, I mean, I wrote down in my notes here, it's like a B12 shot to this movie.
It was my first exposure to Pesci. And when you see what he became through Goodfellas, Casino, just this, I mean, he's 5'4" and just a force to be reckoned with in pretty much everything he's in. But he completely goes against type as this weaselly, just over chatty, kind of like, you know, can't seem to get out of trouble, so to speak, but yep. Just bonds with these guys. Big shout out to my friend Brian Goldberg for when I told him we were doing this and constantly bringing up they fuck you with the drive-thru and just, you know, having such memorable lines and presence with, okay. I mean, it's, again, one of those performances that just will stay with you. And to the fact of bringing him into the two subsequent films and even using him in the marketing for Lethal Weapon 3 was a phenomenal choice.
Yeah, they got him in the poster of Lethal Weapon 3, right? They got like Gibson and Glover, like they're like standing back to back and they've got little like Joe Pesci's head like sticking up like over the logo. I don't love that movie, but I do love that poster. But I mean, like Joe Pesci, this is a guy that comes into Lethal Weapon 2 and like he's obviously done some things before this, but he wasn't a popular actor. Nobody really knew who he was. He was in Easy Money, if I recall, with Rodney Dangerfield, right?
He was his annoying friend who was just trying to get Rodney to play ball. But he was also in Raging Bull, where it was there. Yeah. Was definitely a tease of who he was going to become. But Easy Money, that was such a great little minor role, but very much shades of the Pesci we would grow to see.
I got to think that like Lethal Weapon 2 sort of launched Joe Pesci's career, right? Like, as you said, he was in some films before that, so I'm not suggesting otherwise, but like Lethal Weapon 2 was so popular and his role was so memorable as Leo Getz that like a year later he's in Goodfellas, which is the role that he won his Oscar for and much deserved, working for Martin Scorsese yet again. But he goes on this like crazy run. Home Alone. He's in Home Alone, he's in JFK, he's in My Cousin Vinny, A Bronx Tale, Casino. I don't think any of that happens without him taking Lethal Weapon 2.
The best part about it is when you look at all of those subsequent roles, he's kind of taking a little bit from each movie and putting it together. Like, yeah, I always rewatch Home Alone over the holidays, and it's just, you know, he's intimidating but also vulnerable and just playing up the comedy in such a sweet way and just, you know, this kid besting him every time. So even to the point of, if you remember, The Super, you know, he played, you know, this slumlord who gets sentenced to, you know, live in one of his shitty buildings and has to kind of adapt. So, yeah, he's somebody who seems to almost be a chameleon with everything he's done.
And I think this goes back to what I just said about Richard Donner and the quote that Mel Gibson gave, because I think it was Joe Pesci that pitched to Donner that he wanted to play Leo a little bit more humorously and, like, as he put it, an all too eager to please type. And I think originally it was written as a character, like a very oily, effeminate character. And I think, you know, that's not how Joe Pesci read it. That's how he saw him. So I guess he just went to Richard Donner and said, let me try this out. And I think Donner loved it on the spot. And he's like, yeah, go with that. This is great. And that's how Leo Getz was born. It was all because of the way Pesci kind of tweaked it.
I feel like he stole every scene he was in.
Shane Black's reason for killing Martin Riggs in this draft of the screenplay, as he said in an interview, was that Riggs was a suicidal mess who did not care about living or dying, but his friendship with Murtaugh and his family was what helped him. So sacrificing himself to save them would be the last thing that he would have to do to be fully at peace. Apparently, Shane Black wrote this just beautiful death scene for Martin Riggs that none of us ever got to see. Yet, as I said earlier, they did shoot it because they shot both endings. They shot an ending of him dying, and they shot the ending of Riggs surviving. And I guess when they started doing test screenings, you know, the weeks before the release of this film, audiences, it was just a no-brainer that audiences fell in love with Martin Riggs in the first movie, and they did not want to see him die at the end of Lethal Weapon 2. So everybody was like unanimous that he has to live and he has to survive. So that's why they chose the ending that they chose. Shane Black said that the Play Dirty screenplay was the best thing I have ever written. And this is a guy, Andrew, who's written a lot of big-time movies.
He's still one of my favorites. And, you know, my One of my favorite stories is when he was, you know, for everybody listening who has seen Predator, you know, he's one of the first to die. And it was a ploy by Joel Silver to say, you know, we need help with the script. We're going to put this guy in the movie. We're going to have him down here and he's going to actually help us fix it. So he is one of the greats. He will always be. And I think that, you know, regardless of them not keeping his choice, he birthed the franchise.
You got to give that to him. But he did walk away from this production because he was that upset. They did not choose to go with his version of the sequel and the darker take that he had on it. So he walked away. And that's why Jeffrey Boehm was brought on. And that's why Jeffrey Boehm got full screenplay credit for this film. What I did read is that the villains of the Shane Black script were apparently like nasty. Like, I thought these guys were pretty bad in Lethal Weapon 2. I'm not saying they weren't, but apparently in the screenplay, they were like vicious bastards. And that version of the villain didn't necessarily come to the surface and what we finally got to see on screen. But I guess it was pretty damn dark. But I got to give you a props, man, for mentioning Predator. I knew you were going to mention Predator and that Shane Black was one of the soldiers in that movie. I knew you would mention it and you did. Well done.
Thank you.
Budgeted at $28 million. This movie opened at $20 million opening weekend, ended up grossing $147 million in the U.S. and Canada, $227 million worldwide. Lethal Weapon 2, third highest grossing movie of 1989 behind Batman and Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. I'm not sure if everybody realizes how successful Lethal Weapon 2 was. Number three of the year. That's big. Really big.
That's huge.
Andrew, a point of distinction for this movie is that it's widely considered by many people to be that rare sequel where it's superior to the original. I want to be really clear. I love Lethal Weapon. Came out in 1987. I saw it in the theater. I think it's a very good action film. And when I come across it, I will put the remote down. I'm all in on Lethal Weapon. But I'm going to sit here right on this podcast. I got to tell you, man, I think Lethal Weapon 2 is slightly better. Maybe not by much, but a little bit. What do you think?
I definitely think so, but it's only because it takes a combination of the demons that Riggs was dealing with coming back to be rectified, the introduction of an ancillary character played by Pesci, and then this continued friendship that Riggs and Murtaugh developed to where they're almost saving each other. Because when you look at the first movie, I mean, this movie is truly a story about friendship. And I think when you look at one, you know, they're saving each other. But this is a continuation of that and how they're continuing to kind of deepen. And it's, you know, I don't want to say it's a male love story, but it's a true friendship love story when you break it down. And it just combines all of those elements of action, darkness, a compelling story. And it also just, you know, one of the best traits of a great movie is having you sucked in right from the first scene. And both one and two do that. But two, you're just right in a car chase, yep, right immediately in the action. And it's like, okay, we're in, you know, we're along for the ride.
I referenced that earlier when we talked about the Looney Tunes music, right? And you stop and think about it for a second. What I love about Lethal Weapon 2, everything that you just said, I completely agree with. And we have a whole section that's coming up here about the heart of this movie. So I think that the heart of this movie is really special. And I think it gives this movie just a different kind of experience for the viewer than I think the first one has. If you go back and look at the original Lethal Weapon poster, it's kind of black and white. It's got a lot of silver. It's got the red logo and it looks like a great action movie. And then the poster for the second one is just a very simple photograph of Riggs and Murtaugh. And the line, it's great. And it says, "The magic is back." So then you watch the movie, you've got the Looney Tunes music. And it, like you said, they throw you right in. Like, I think they knew when they were making this movie, that this movie is the shit. And the marketing sort of treats it that way. Like, all they say is the magic is back. I mean, how arrogant and like confident is that line that's all they put on this poster? It's a very simple poster. Picture of Gibson and Glover and the magic is back. That's all it says. Nothing else.
It's the age-old tale of less is more.
Yeah.
And we don't have to make things, 50 million times bigger than they need to be. Just simple. Keep it simple.
I think they knew that this movie was going to just play and they didn't overthink it in the way they brought it out, which is really what I love about it. So I think that's why it's one of those rare sequels. But I had given you some homework.
Yep.
There are sequels that are better than the first one, right? And that could be debated. That could be argued. We're going to talk about a few of those in a minute. Then there are the sequels that are like, I think they just fell short. Like they're fine. They're decent movies, but they're not better than the first one. And then there's the other ones that are just, they're like dumpster fires, right?
Yeah.
So let's break this list down into like three tiers. Give me some of your movies that you think are better than the first one.
So I really focused on the overall better ones because I don't want to really shit on a lot that I think kind of fell short. I feel like I have a pretty solid list here. Listen, this is in no particular order, but yep. Godfather Part Two,
yep.
we know stands on its own, but you can never marginalize what the first one was. It's just one of those movies that two just took it to yet another level. But like the greatness of both those movies, they're in their own realm. That's it.
I think everybody would agree with you on that.
Terminator 2.
Sure.
Hands down. I mean, but the first one, again, for what it did and what it was shot on and just how it, again, birthed an entire franchise. But two, amped it up a whole other level. Along those lines, Aliens.
Yeah.
You know, in the first one, we're dealing with one alien. Oh my God, we're now in a planet filled. So it just, it kept building. And I think that that's, it's not saying that one wasn't as good. It's just two built on the greatness of its predecessor, more or less. Empire Strikes Back, which I know we've, you and I have both shared a mutual love for. And it was one of those movies that as a kid, I was like, oh man, this is so dark. And I loved Jedi. But I watched that movie now. Oh my God, it is just incredible. It is the best of the bunch. The Dark Knight.
Yep.
Again, like Batman Begins was great because a whole new take on the franchise. But you know, listen, Ledger's performance, winning the Oscar posthumously. Wow. Every time that movie's on, I'm sucked in. I have to give an honorable mention to Ocean's 12 just because it stands on its own. And it's not like, oh my God, because one was amazing, but two was a different movie. And I just think that there was something very charming about two. And I think it got a bad rap because it didn't have like the Vegas sexiness. But two, you know, you're on a trip to Europe. You know, it really just felt like a nice, fun and different part of the franchise.
I wouldn't have put it on my list, but I really applaud you for putting it in there for what it was. It was fine. Like I probably haven't seen that movie as many times as maybe other people or I should have seen it, but I did like it, but I didn't love it like I loved the first one. But that's fair. I'll give you that one.
Thank you. I've got a few more. This is only because when you're a kid and I mentioned the carnage, you're kind of sucked in, but First Blood Part Two,
sure.
Rambo. I mean, but the first Rambo First Blood is an incredible movie, but they took out all of the psychological components of the first and just created this badass action movie. Yeah, for what it is, and when you're kind of like this, you know, excited kid watching more action, that's what you want to see. You want to see the carnage. So
there are two very different movies, and you're talking to a guy who did First Blood already on this podcast, and I did it a while ago. I did it like a couple years ago with Jason Thompson, and it's one of my very favorite movies. So I think it's far superior to Rambo 2. But when I was 14 years old, man, I probably saw Rambo 2 five times that summer in the theater. I loved it. I had every poster of it on my wall in my bedroom. Like I was all in on John Rambo blowing people away with the M60 and just mowing guys down. Like I was all about that. So like I get why you have it there on the list. But as a comparison, First Blood is a much better film than Rambo 2. But Rambo 2 is a lot of fun.
100% will agree. And I just have it for what it was.
Yep.
And at the time.
I give it to you. Yep.
Thank you. Lord of the Rings, Two Towers. Listen, I'm not going to take away from the Fellowship, but I remember seeing Two Towers in theaters and the battle for Helm's Deep. I was like, okay, this just took it to another level. So that was that was incredible. Young Guns 2, which I know we recently talked about.
You sure did.
Yes, just better than the first one. But again, first one not being bad, it just took it to a whole other level. My dark horse for you.
Ooh, which I'm intrigued. What do you got?
Conan the Destroyer.
Oh, wow. Jeez.
That, to me, is just a better overall fun movie. You know, I don't want to take away from the first one and what it did and putting Arnold on the map. But, man, two, you had Wilt. You had Grace Jones. Awesome. Awesome sequel.
I think I saw that movie maybe once, possibly twice. So I'd have to go back and revisit that to really acknowledge that suggestion. But I'll give you that one. I'll give you a partial credit for that one.
Police Academy 2. You referenced Police Academy, the first one, but Police Academy 2, hands down. Sure. Just just a phenomenal addition to the franchise.
Well, the supermarket scene when Bobcat Goldthwait goes into that supermarket with all those guys and just how funny he was, the way he delivered his lines was wonderful.
I mean, guys, I don't want to do the voice, but guys, come on. I mean, act your age. So, you know, and then he rips out the banana.
Yep.
It's classic. I quote that movie still to this day. Having just saw it, Dune Part 2, got to tell you.
That's what everybody's saying. Then I mean, I've read stuff online that's like the greatest movie ever made already. That's what people are talking about Dune 2. Is it that good?
It's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah,
it really is, and it just has that epic feel. And you could absolutely see like what Star Wars kind of took from that, just based on, you know, I know when Frank Herbert wrote it. It just has that epic feel, and you know, you have a who's who of everybody who's hot right now, but everybody holds their own, and it's. Yeah, it was pretty incredible.
Nice.
And this is my last one that's going to kind of segue to just what I call a second, another chapter. I saw Rocky II before I saw the original Rocky.
Okay.
Again, as a kid, I was so over the moon to see Rocky win the title. You know, you watch one now, oh my God, one won the Oscar. I mean, he won the Oscar, like just an incredible movie, yep. Underdog story. Rocky IV is hands down one of my all-time favorite movies. That is just... That is in a league in and of itself. But referencing to as a child, I just thought it was better because of what it meant. But again, as you get older and you have a better appreciation, I know one is a much, much better film. But two at the time, you know, because he won also, it was great.
Your list is impressive. I had all those. I didn't have Conan the Destroyer or Ocean's 12. The only one that I have here that you didn't – oh, actually, there's two that I have that you didn't mention. One is The Road Warrior, speaking of Mel Gibson. I do think that The Road Warrior was slightly better than the original Mad Max. But I will say that Mad Max Fury Road was insanely amazing and was probably one of my favorite movies of the last decade. Came across that the other day when I was channel surfing, and I watched it for a good hour, and it's still pretty amazing. But the one that I would reference is Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Where was that on your list?
I think I just didn't think about Star Trek just based on what that franchise is, the TV show, etc. But as a child, seeing that creature crawl into the ear of Chekhov, oh my God, it scared the living shit out of me. So yes, I would say that The Wrath of Khan, 100% better.
He put things in our ears, made us say things. I just said that for my brother because Jim and I quote Star Trek II quite a bit. We're big fans of The Wrath of Khan. Let's keep going. Sequels which fell short.
Botany Bay. Oh no.
Botany Bay. Oh no. Oh my God. Die Hard 2, Beverly Hills Cop 2, and Ghostbusters 2 are three that I came up with that are like, you know, they're fine. They're fine. But they're not close to the first ones, right?
I mean, I have Cop 2 on a separate list as part of our discussion. But yeah, I don't want to take away. You know, I just think that, yeah, Die Hard 2, I can't, you know, Die Hard 1 hands down.
Oh, but yes. It's not even close.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, John McTiernan didn't direct Die Hard 2. He went off and did Red October. That's why Rennie Harlan was brought in. And listen, Tony Scott, who's a really talented filmmaker, directed Beverly Hills Cop 2. And you can tell when you watch it, it's got a totally different aesthetic, and it's fine. Like it's on cable a lot, and I enjoy it for what it is, but it's not Beverly Hills Cop. And then there's real quickly, then we're going to move on. But like the bad ones, like the bad sequels, the only three that I came up with were Weekend at Bernie's 2, Caddyshack 2, which is an abomination. And then Predator 2. None of those are good at all.
I debated on putting Caddyshack 2 on my list. And again, this is a shout out to Brian Goldberg because he and I quote it all the time.
What?
It is not better than one. It never will be because one is amazing. But there is something special about two if you really watch it. Randy Quaid is next level in it. He is just, I mean... It's almost worth a rewatch just to see and hear what he's doing, what he's saying. And Dan Aykroyd, forget it. There are some great pieces about it. It is not better than one, but it is I love it.
I don't even understand how it shares the same name as the first movie. Listen, you're going hard, man. That's the one with Jackie Mason, right?
Yeah.
Dude, I'm never gonna watch Caddyshack 2 again, ever. I mean, you're gonna have to really pitch me hard on that. And you just tried.
I'm not gonna push it more, but I will just tell you that Randy Quaid is just next level, and there is something so phenomenal about it. But again, It will not go anywhere near the first one. It just stands on its own.
Look, sequels are hard to do. I do want to give a shout out to the John Wick franchise because those are obviously enormously successful. I'm a huge fan of the first one, which came out 10 years ago already. And that's a movie I would love to revisit on this podcast, the first John Wick. I love the universe building they did in that. And I love the mythology and the storyline and the gold coins. But I will give props to the sequels. Like, I thought each one, bigger budget, one after another, and the movies got bigger in scope. All four of them, I think, are all really good action films. And I don't feel like the franchise has gotten tired yet. I don't have anything bad to say about those four movies. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, I mean, I'll never forget seeing the first one. I was on a business trip up in NorCal, and it was the time when, you know, which they still have the Saturday night 8 p.m. HBO movie. And I was coming back from an all day conference on that Saturday, and I was like, oh, John Wick's on. I was just like, oh, my God, this movie. Where did this movie come from? Like, right? it was pretty incredible. And I do think that the sequels have all kind of stood on their own. I think that the second one probably is the best of the sequels.
Of the three that they made. Yep.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, I would agree with that. It was funny. Like, I think I don't even know how John Wick got on my radar. I was living in Atlanta at the time. And I remember hearing about this little movie that was coming out with Keanu Reeves. And he was playing this assassin. And I was just like, that sounds interesting to me. There was something about it. And I remember I went to go see it on a Saturday afternoon. And I went to go see it by myself. And I was like, I just want to go see this. And I walked out of it. And I was like, I just knew that I saw something wholly original that was like probably going to go on my list of one of the best things I had seen that year. And I was telling everybody about it. And the movie didn't play in theaters that long. It wasn't that successful compared to the sequels. But like, I was telling everybody, man, you got to go see this movie called John Wick. They kill his dog and this guy goes crazy. And it's just like, it's just insane. That's the story. I mean, that was it. There was nothing more to it.
Something's wrong.
No. Really?
This is our goddamn pen.
You were saying about the pen?
Oh, it just reminds me of something.
Reminds you of what?
Oh, it reminds me of Father Night Vicky was killed.
I didn't mean to push.
I know, that's okay. We never really talked about this, did we? Well, I was supposed to be meeting her for dinner and, you know, one of those romantic dinners for two. Well, I was up to my eyeballs in work. And, I forgot about the whole thing. I guess she waited at the restaurant for an hour before she decided to drive home alone. It's been midnight before I got home. I got home to a ringing phone, so naturally I answered it. They told me she was killed in a car crash. I should have been driving it. I guess we'd have been all right, huh? Anyway, I remember falling down on my knees and I started shaking all over and I remember thinking, I'm losing it. I'm just losing it. So there I was, lying on the living room floor. Lying there. And I'm seeing under the couch. And I see this gold pen. Gold pen just lying there under the couch. I've been looking for it everywhere. I've been looking for it. I haven't seen it in 2 months. There it is. She wasn't much of a housekeeper. And this voice goes off inside my head, you know, kind of like a drill instructor. I really heard it. It said, get up now. I didn't feel like it, but I got up. Muscles were still working. And I drove to the hospital and identified her in the morgue. And signed her out with my gold pen.
Gold pen? Hey, Trish found a gold pen in the laundry.
Let's talk about the franchise of Lethal Weapon. You know, these movies were produced by Joel Silver. I've talked about Joel Silver previously. We referenced him in the episode about Roadhouse. This guy had his hands on just about every major 80s movie that you can think of. 48 Hours, Commando, Die Hard, Predator. Joel Silver produced all of those. He produced Lethal Weapon, Lethal Weapon 2, and the others. Where does this franchise sit for you? I mean, is it fair to say that this is one of the most successful action franchises of our generation?
I would say so. And also just the fact that it's built on original IP is pretty amazing when you think about that. And the fact that four movies, there supposedly is a fifth, even when you go to IMDb, there's actually a one sheet for it, which is, I mean, I'm just waiting to see when that's going to happen. There was a TV show.
Yep.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those that you will always see a cable run, whether that's premium it's showing up on streaming. It shows up on Basic. I still love one of the scenes in 4 when they're fighting Jet Li. I mean, it's just one of those that, you know, will continue no matter where you are, just to like bring you in at any given moment. And I think from a generational perspective, when you think about when the TV show came out and when the first movie came out, I mean, it's a pretty long run for a franchise to have sustained.
You know, it's interesting. Like, I think there were other buddy cop movies that came along before Lethal Weapon in 87. I mean, I'm just looking at my list. I mean, 48 Hours came out in 1982. You've got, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, or a couple of cops, and Eddie Murphy. So, yeah, with three of them, I guess. But Running Scared with Gregory Hines and Billy Crystal came out a year before. But there was something about Lethal Weapon when it comes out in 87. I sort of feel like it redefined the genre a little bit. You've got this unhinged madman. You've got this family man. And it's interesting, like, as we said earlier, Lethal Weapon is a pretty dark movie. I mean, if you stop and really analyze that film, this is like, it's a very well-made, very dark. You've got there's this post-Vietnam PTSD subtext that's running through it with not only the Gibson character, but with some of the other people in the movie. And, you know, Rick sticks a gun in his mouth, like, within the first 10 minutes of this movie, this guy almost commits suicide in his trailer because he's in such grief about the loss of his wife. And you've got special forces mercenaries. This is a hard movie, man. Lethal Weapon's a hard movie. And I guess I could see why, you know, Warner Brothers and Richard Donner wanted to lighten the mood a little bit, because it was pretty dark stuff. The way that even the ending takes place on the front lawn of Murtaugh's house, and there's the fire hydrant and the water and the fight. Like,
I understand why my father was a little, you know, afraid to show me the movie because of the torture scene. But at the same time, I don't think we'd really seen a movie that had a showdown between the main villain and our hero.
Yep.
That was just an epic fight. I mean, where it's like, we're going to actually just do battle because I'm so pissed at you for, you know, every time you've just tried to kill me. And you would have never thought that it was going to lead to that. But that was such an incredible way to end the movie.
He's like, what do you say, Jack? You want your shot at the title? And they just start going at it.
Don't mind if I do.
But even like right before that fight scene, I mean, when they show Gary Busey, he's like driving up to Murtaugh's house, and he just kills those two cops in the car that are out there, like, watching guard, like, cold-blooded, like, shot him in the head. Like, again, really dark. Like, and Lethal Weapon 2 has got some darkness, too. I'm not saying it doesn't, but, like, it's a lot lighter of a film than the first movie. But there was something about that first movie that connected with moviegoers, and I'm not surprised that they wanted to go back and bring these characters back to us. A lot of humor, great rapport between Gibson and Glover. There was just something about that recipe that worked. But, like, what are the other buddy cop movies that stand out to you? I mean, I referenced 48 Hours already. I referenced Beverly Hills Cop. Do you have others?
Tango and Cash, which...
Good one.
Yeah. No, I mean, that was, again, one of those seeing in the theater. I remember going to my local VHS store and asking if I could buy it. And at the time, it was like the only copy, and it was going to be like $75. I'm like, I can't afford that, like, you know, at that age. But Tango and Cash, another shout out to Shane Black for The Last Boy Scout.
Yep.
Also with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Rush Hour, Bad Boys. I actually do have Beverly Hills Cop 2 on here just because they brought Rosewood and Taggart kind of into the mix, and that really kind of sticks to the formula. Stakeout. I'm going to go a little old school classic on you with The Heat of the Night.
Ooh, nicely done.
That's a solid one. You already referenced Running Scared. I have kind of a nice little tucked away gem, a little Red Heat, Arnold and Belushi.
Early Arnold, yeah.
I have a soft spot for that movie. The Hard Way, a little Michael J. Fox, James Woods, a nice comedic tone. Rising Sun, you've got Snipes and Connery. Black Rain with
Andy Garcia and Michael Douglas, right?
Yeah, but then remember, Andy Garcia dies, and then he teams up with the Japanese cop to take him out. So it's almost like it was a really clever kind of like insertion. So it's like I get one partner, then I get another one as I'm adapting. And then I'm gonna flip it with a little The Heat, Sandra Bullock and Melissa McCarthy, which I remember seeing a screening. I was like, oh, this movie is actually pretty amazing.
I had Midnight Run. Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin, and that's another one that I'm absolutely going to do a pod on.
I almost had Midnight Run, and this was where I was trying to be a little bit more defined of like what constitutes buddy cop, because as I was doing my research, Point Break can show up on that list, but it's not really a buddy cop movie because you have an FBI agent trying to take down, you know, a criminal, and I think that you know, we could argue that, sure, Midnight Run has those elements. So
I love that you referenced Stakeout. I'm a big fan of Stakeout. Before we move on, I guess like the last thing I'll ask you about the franchise, how you stack them, right? Like as far as like to me, the first two movies, as we just said, Lethal Weapon 2 is possibly even better than the first one. And then I think 3 comes along and it just felt tired. It felt like the movie like raced to the finish line. And I'm not sure if that's true or not, but the movie just didn't feel like it was fully complete. The ending wasn't great. It takes place in a housing development that's under construction and there's a fire. And it was fine. It wasn't great. The villain wasn't very memorable. And then I think the fourth one is just a dumpster fire. I hated the fourth one. I've seen it, but I haven't seen it probably more than twice. So
I would say, you know, if you're ranking them, I would put 2 just ahead of 1. You know, but again, like they're like top 2. Oddly, I'm going to go 4 ahead of 3 only because I think that there was a great addition with Chris Rock and Jet Li. I know they were trying to capitalize on so much. I just think 3, as much as I wanted to love it, I think Rene Russo was great. And that was nice to give Riggs, you know, his overdue love and like continue Pesci's adventure. It definitely just missed. It really did.
I want to talk about the heart of Lethal Weapon 2. We talked about this a few minutes ago, and I'm so glad you brought it up because there's a lot of heart in this movie. And I think sometimes everybody just sort of remembers Lethal Weapon 2 for diplomatic immunity and the South African villains and all that. But there's so much more under the surface of this movie. If you stop and talk about it, like you mentioned earlier, this is a movie about friendship. This is a movie about family. And they established that. They established it in the original at times. There was that scene when Martin first goes to the Murtaugh's, the very first time you meet his family in the first movie. And I thought that, you know, and then they're out on the fishing boat drinking beers. And again, like there was a little bit of that there, but in the second one, they establish it really early on when they go back to the Murtaugh house and they're all gathering around the TV, watching Rianne's commercial, which happens to be for condoms, which in and of itself was very, very amusing. But like the way like Riggs is sitting on the couch and the way they're sitting there, and he's got that great scene with you know, Raj's wife, Trish, about the pen. And he talks about how she found the pen in the laundry. And Riggs talks about the significance of the pen. And there's some really great scenes early on in this movie that just establish these characters. And you just kind of like fall back in love with them, you know, 2 years later, right?
These scenes are not throwaway scenes. I mean, they're definitely, they move the story along. They give us more insight into who these characters are. And it really continues the humanity and kind of the progression that we see, because as we, you know, come to learn in the first one, you know, how much of a mess Riggs is about losing his wife. But you kind of see this metamorphosis from him, especially when he's talking to Trish about that and just how he's really become, you know, a little bit more of a whole guy again. You know, he's almost been rebuilt. Yep. And it's really thanks to the family.
Riggs doesn't seem as suicidal as he probably was, you know, in the first film, right? In the first movie, the guy's putting a gun in his mouth and he jumps off the building with that one guy. Like, you know, he had a death wish, and that they dial that back in the second one. And I think it's to great effect. But they also did a great job of establishing the camaraderie of the detectives. Did you notice that in the second movie, where like even early on when Riggs tells everybody that Roger's daughter, Rianne, is going to be on TV that night in this commercial, and none of them realize it was for a condom at that point. But like, all the guys are there. They're all like making jokes about it the next day when they all watch the commercial, and they all like had the rubbers on Roger's desk. There was just like this family bonding element that they established really early on. And you sort of fell in love with these detectives, because when they all start, you know, falling down at the end of this movie, one by one, by these villains, like you really feel for that.
The important thing also about it is you only have 3 kind of department characters from the first one that make it into the second one. So, and that's also part of kind of maintaining that familial component. So you have the therapist played by Mary Ellen Trainer, which we know she had a phenomenal run in the 80s and 90s. You have the police chief, who I think is he was like Donner's brother-in-law or something along those lines. But there is a relation to Donner.
There's a connection there. Yeah.
And then one of the cop who basically tells Murtaugh about him being partnered up with Riggs in the first one, he makes he's an add-on for the second. But yeah, I mean, it was actually great just because we could see a glimpse into these characters, and it also made us care more because of how ruthless the villains were and what they were doing to the to the police department.
I've never read the Jeffrey Boehm screenplay. That's different from the one that Shane Black wrote, obviously. But you have to think that these are the elements that Boehm must have brought to this film. You know, he obviously dialed up the Joe Pesci character and he made us fall in love with him. All these other pieces that we just talked about, it sort of sounds like to me that a lot of that stuff was probably not in the original Shane Black screenplay for this, the movie was going to be that dark. I love the fact that they gave Riggs a chance to sort of maybe not fall in love with somebody in Lethal Weapon 2, but he definitely had a thing for the character Rika, who works for the South African consulate, and unfortunately doesn't end well for her. But the fact that they let him have that moment in the film where he has the date with her at his trailer, and it was nice that they took their time to let him experience romance again.
He was just making his way back, and it was a good glimpse. I mean, and you know, kind of leading to 3 with him actually finding love. So definitely a great choice.
Until I tell you, you got that. You got that, Riggs. You're not dead until I tell you. You got that, Riggs? You're not dead until I tell you. Now breathe. Let me breathe. Now breathe.
Hey, breathe.
Okay. Yeah.
Roger.
Yeah.
All right. Roger, my pocket.
Okay.
In my pocket.
Buddy,
I want you to throw those things away. Those things will kill you.
Ready? You son of a bitch. I thought you would die here in my arms.
Come on, come on, man. I didn't die in your toilet. I'm not going to die in your arms. So you're a good
please, son of a bitch.
Where are they? Are they all gone? Bad guys, you get them?
They've been decaffeinated.
Oh, you fuck!
Oh, don't make me laugh.
Oh, Jesus.
Remember just absolutely loving this decision that Donner makes in this movie. But at the end of the film, when, you know, when Riggs gets shot by Rudd and Murtaugh puts him down, and then he has to like kind of climb down the ladder and he runs to and you as a viewer, like Riggs takes like 3 bullets, right? Or something like that. And he's laying down and you're not quite sure if he was going to live. But Donner makes this great directorial decision where they start playing Eric Clapton and Knocking on Heaven's Door on the soundtrack, which in a scene like this, it almost shouldn't work. It's not supposed to work, but it does work. And like he even takes the camera and he kind of like they go back up to the bridge and they show all the cop cars coming at a distance. You hear the sirens coming and the camera sort of pans across this bridge before it goes back down to the warehouse where they are. And you pick back up with Riggs and Murtaugh and Murtaugh is comforting him. And he's you're not dead until I tell you all that. But the fact that they're playing that with the Clapton music of Knocking on Heaven's Door, I think that's an absolutely amazing decision. I love it.
And just the fact that they're sharing a good laugh and they're talking about, you know, cigarettes will kill you type thing. And it's just, there have been so many moments in the movie about being close to death and just, you know, it really brought everything full circle that they're continuing to save each other.
It's almost a little bit too heavy-handed that they played Knocking on Heaven's Door when Riggs is laying on the ground and he's near death. And it's a little bit too much on the nose. And I would admit that. But like I said, it's not supposed to work, but it does work. And I mean, shit, I remember running out and getting the soundtrack for this movie because I was a film score collector back then. But I wanted to have Cheer Down on my CD, and I wanted to have that version of Knocking on Heaven's Door. And let's give a shout out now, I guess, to the great score. You referenced Michael Kamen earlier in this episode, but like him and Eric Clapton and David Sanborn, that is a combination that is not supposed to work for a film score, and it works great in both movies.
You just said something, and I have to shout out to my old friend Neil Cohan, who actually is an agent for composers and supervisors, and I will ask him for very obscure scores just because I have such a deep love for film scores as well. And I will say that probably my favorite part of the score is actually the tow truck chase scene.
Yep.
And that choice of orchestral music, it's the same music that he used in Lethal One right when they're escaping the nightclub and he's going after Busey. And it just has this like epic feel to it. Oh my God, man. It's so good.
The last thing I'll say, and it was great that you referenced the fact that like they're both having a laugh at the end of this movie when, you know, Riggs is sitting there and he's a bloody mess and, you know, the bad guys have been decaffeinated and like, these cheesy lines, but like the
decaffeinated line, I was like, I was like, are you kidding me right now? It was great.
Yeah. But the fact that like Donner ends this movie with George Harrison's Cheer Down and like, and it's funny, like 35 years later, I can't think of Lethal Weapon 2 without Cheer Down and George Harrison. It's just like, they just go hand in hand for me. And I just love the way they play that song and the camera just pulls back from the docks and you see LA at night and you see the bridge and the camera on the helicopter is sort of pulling back as they roll the end credits. But what a great song. I mean, sometimes movies end with songs that just don't work. And I think Cheer Down was just sort of captured the spirit of Lethal Weapon 2 quite well. And I know this is a deep cut here that we're talking about the song that most people probably don't know. It's not a very popular George Harrison song, but I'm a big fan of it. Are there moments from this film that really sort of jump out at you? I know you just mentioned the truck chase with the guy that gets killed by the surfboard and one of the great moments of this film, but this movie's full of those. I mean, there's a bunch of really great sequences. Are there any that are special to you?
I think that the fact that they continue to find creative ways of attempting to kill people is really, really something that is, yes, I don't know what that says about my psyche, but I think it's pretty amazing. You have somebody attempting to get blown up off a toilet, somebody tragically dying from the diving board off the pool.
Yeah, at the pool. Sure.
You know, you have the poker game death. You have somebody sadly who's just doing an inversion who gets shot. Listen, the stilt house getting ripped down. It's just all the creativity in coming up with that is pretty amazing. I do have one little bone to pick, which I thought was such an amazing scene. But, you know, with them crashing out of the hotel room, with room service, that glass kind of shattered a little easily. And I know we've all been in hotel rooms and they don't really shatter that easily, even though you could think that the momentum is going to carry you. But I don't know. I mean, you'd have to be going really, really fast to have kind of knocked that out.
Yeah, I'm not sure if a room service cart is going to move fast enough to have that much force to break that window down for those guys to fall into the pool. It's funny you brought up that hotel. That hotel was the old Park Hyatt. It's in Century City. It sits right next to Nakatomi Plaza, which is adjacent to the Fox Studios lot. Now, you and I both know this because we both live out here, but I'm not sure when people watch Lethal Weapon 2 that did they know in that pool scene that the Die Hard building is literally right next door.
Every time I go to Century City, I always say there's Nakatomi Plaza. Just going back to, why this movie rocks is amazing one-liners, the heart, the humor, the action. There is never really a lull in this movie. And at the runtime, sub 2 hours, it just continues to keep you going. And I don't know. I mean, I don't really see a weak part of it, so to speak. It's just something that it just continues with, like, you have a very heavy scene, at the consulate, and then you have them, getting drive-through food and Leo having the car door knocked off. I mean, it's just going to continue. Oh, and I have to call out, oh my God, Riggs escaping from the straitjacket, that then coming back around. It's like, okay, yep, that is one of the coolest things ever. And then also seeing the nail gun. Wow, that thing comes back around again. And it's like, this is one of the coolest things I've ever seen. So such a great choice by the screenwriter to introduce those things and then have them come back around later.
The guy's like, this is no Saturday Night Special. Yeah, there was some great foreshadowing there where they introduced that nail gun early on at Roger's construction. And then they bring it back at the end. I love the fact that they introduced these villains. These guys that work at the South African consulate, these are obviously shady people. These are drug smugglers. And I love the fact that there's like this apartheid subtext that's running throughout this film. And it was very topical in the late 80s, right? It gives Danny Glover this great scene at the consulate when he's talking about one man, one vote. And Danny Glover actually played Nelson Mandela in an HBO film that came out a year, maybe that same year as Lethal Weapon, I want to say. But like, even though going back to the toilet scene, this element of this black man sitting on the toilet and this white man goes there to help save his life. And there's that great shot that Donner has of right before he pulls him off the toilet, and you see their hands cross, right? And you see the black hand and the white hand sort of crisscrossing and touching each other. And these guys are brothers. And like, and that's not a coincidence that these villains are, you know, racist. There's just something there that really brings this movie home, where they use that as part of the villain storyline. And it really worked hard for me.
I think that it was obviously very apropos to have something that was so prevalent in the current economy to bring that into the fold for us to kind of root against. So it's, you know, I feel like now in Top Gun Maverick is kind of a perfect example of it. You don't, it's kind of an unseen enemy now. You know, you don't really have a face to who or what the enemy is. So I think that, you know, adding that current event component was definitely, it definitely helped us root for the good guys.
The one thing that you didn't mention that I have to add in at the end is when Riggs gets thrown off into the water with the straitjacket, right? And he gets himself out and he sees that they killed Rika, which is pretty devastating. And there was an alternate ending to this film where Rika lives and she was actually going to go to the Murtaugh's with Martin, and they were going to celebrate Thanksgiving together. And that was something they shot, but Richard Donner decided that he felt like she needed to die so we can actually see the rage of Martin Riggs. And I thought that was really well done, where when Riggs sees her dead and he comes out of the water and those two goons are sitting there by the car, and he goes over there with a chain, right? He gets that chain off that motor, off that boat. And then he takes that one guy and he just puts him into the car door, and he just slams that car door on that guy's neck like three times. Dude, that's a crazy kill.
One of the best moments also. It's like, you know, you've always been warned about not getting your finger slammed in the car door or anything like that. And the fact to actually see somebody getting just, you know, killed that way, pretty amazing.
And then like Murtaugh calls Riggs, and Riggs is in his truck and he's like on his way to the still house. And he's like, I'm going to get those guys, Roger. I'm going to get them and fuck them. And like, this guy's fired up, man. He's like upset.
Yeah.
And Murtaugh knows. He knows that like he's not going to be able to stop Riggs here. This is the way this movie is going to end. And like, he takes his badge and he takes it off and he puts it in the drawer in his desk, because he knows, like, he's like, I'm not a cop tonight, Roger. It's personal. I love that, man. That is like, Riggs is like ready to roll. Man, that's good stuff. I'm getting fired up just talking about it right now.
I definitely agree.
Some fun facts about Lethal Weapon 2. I did not know this. I'm not sure if you knew this, but Lethal Weapon 2 was one of the very first summer blockbusters to feature the what they call the title only style of openings, which means like when the studio logo comes off the screen, all you see is the title of the movie and then the movie starts, right? Back then, most movies opened with the opening credits. They play, you know, they show the actor's name and the name of the movie and the casting director, the music, and so forth, and they show all the credits. Lethal Weapon 2 just opens with Lethal Weapon 2, and to your point earlier, just jumps right into the car chase, and the credits don't even come till the end of the film. A lot of movies have now since emulated that, but back in the late 80s, Lethal Weapon 2 was one of the very first movies that did that.
Yeah, I think that saving every Tom, Dick, and Harry till the end, I mean, it just saved us from, like, I don't know if it's necessarily just an edit that they decided, okay, we're going to, you know, just start this thing right out of the floodgates, as we've said. I think it was a phenomenal choice, just because, you know, it also forces you to stay after. This was obviously pre-internet to see, oh, it was that actor or that actor. Yep. So, no, I definitely agree it was a great choice.
Bruce Willis was originally set to play Martin Riggs in Lethal Weapon, which I did not know. He passed and went on to do a little passion project called Die Hard. I think it worked out well for Bruce Willis, Andrew, and it worked out well for Mel Gibson.
I would agree. Two franchises were birthed, although I think that Bruce Willis would have probably been a pretty solid Riggs, just because. So
I wouldn't mind seeing like a screen test for that or something like that if one existed. Coincidentally, Die Hard with a Vengeance, which was the third Die Hard movie, that actually originated from a screenplay that was commissioned to be a Lethal Weapon sequel. I did not know that.
I did not know that either.
The still house, which is where the South Africans are doing their dirty deeds, is actually a real house in Los Angeles. It's called the Garcia House, which is designed by some renowned designer who I've never heard of named John Lautner. And that house actually recently listed for $16 million. I'm not sure if anybody bought it or not. They built a replica of that house so Riggs could actually tear it down with his truck. But it's actually a real place. Have you ever driven by it?
I haven't, but I definitely will say that anytime I'm at a stilt house, I always think about that scene, and I always get a little, there's just a little twinge of fear anytime I'm on the balcony of a stilt house.
Do you think that you and I maybe need to do like a field trip and go see the stilt house one of these days and do like a selfie or something?
I'm totally game. Totally game.
Anything else on Lethal Weapon 2? Any final thoughts?
Why would Rianne not have told her parents that the commercial was a condom commercial? And also the fact that it was premiering at 8 o'clock. I'm like, wait, what kind is this, an advertorial? Because we know that a commercial is not going to be right at 8 o'clock. It's going to be at 8:07 or what have you. But it was definitely like interesting choice, but at the same time worked for the story. Like, awesome. And then I was curious also when they go to get Leo, you know, were there any guards already watching him? Like, because they just show up and it's like he's just in this room and nobody's kind of like overseeing him. I will also say that during the tow truck chase, they just happen to spot Riggs's gun, you know?
that's a tough one to swallow. I agree on that.
They were going pretty fast. I'm like, oh, you know, it's like Costanza spotting dimes on the highway, you know? A little Seinfeld reference there. Two other ones. Why does Vorsted, a.k.a. Adolf, he doesn't recognize Riggs when he was the guy who was putting a hit out on him? So right. Wouldn't he have had a picture of Riggs? Like, but you could argue, oh, you know, it was just because he was tracking the car. But at the same time, that was a little bit of an inconsistency, at least to me. But again, it works for the sake of the movie. And then one final one. I was just curious why Riggs would have taken Rika to her place, knowing like what just transpired after he was just, you know, both of them are almost gunned down.
Those are all fantastic questions, by the way. And I'll give you the one about the gun on the road. How they spotted that gun on the side of the road when they were in that chase is pretty absurd. But, you know, whatever. It's Lethal Weapon 2. The movie's awesome, and that's fine by me. But would Rudd have written down the name of the ship, the Alba Varden, on a notepad on his desk and just leave it there for anybody to come by, including Martin Riggs, who does come by and pulls off the sheet? Like, come on, man. Like, I mean, I know this is pre-internet, pre-smartphones, but like, something that important and sensitive, you're not leaving that on a notepad on your desk at the consulate. You're just not.
But we also have to mention the fact that Murtaugh was just so knowledgeable about, you know, the fact that it's a freight, a shipping liner. I mean, come on, you know, that was also, but again, like these things work. They just work for the sake of it. We can, you know, say they're little bones to pick, but at the same time, we're just going to enjoy the ride. So these are just little bits.
If I came across all that drug money in that little container, man, I'd be really tempted to take a couple of those and put those in my pocket. I'm not sure about you, Andrew. I know it's drug money and you don't really want to touch that dirty drug money, man. But there was a lot of it sitting there. And as Murtaugh said, he put his kids through school with that. Just at least think about it.
I agree. But I do think that it was such a phenomenal choice that they did a little bit of a callback also, because when you remember when Riggs wins the bets from you know, escaping from the straitjacket, and somebody had actually taken one of the Cougarans, and Murtaugh was like,
That's right.
This is evidence. You know what I mean? So I actually think that really kind of placed his moral character. And I will also reference Lethal Weapon 4. Murtaugh is kind of decked out. He's wearing like nicer threads. And there's a whole thing in that movie about how Mel Gibson confronts him and saying, you know, everybody thinks you're on the take. And he's like, no, Trish actually is this kind of like ghost author, and she's made all this money that way. So I actually think that it was such a great thing that he stuck to that. You know, he stuck to his morals that way. But yes, I will definitely say, it is tempting.
I found it interesting when I rewatched this movie. You know, this movie, I'm 18 years old when this movie comes out. And when you're 18 years old, you just don't have any sort of concept of like how old people are, right? Like when I was 18 watching Lethal Weapon 2, I would have guessed that like Mel Gibson was probably in his like 40s, right? Because he's like an older guy, right? And like, and Murtaugh is probably like supposed to be in his 50s. But like when they shot that movie, Mel Gibson was only 33, which is like 20 years younger than I am now. Glover is 43. And I just find it kind of amazing that that's how young they were back then. Because like Mel Gibson really does look really young in the movie, but I never would have guessed that he was 33 years old when I was watching that when I was 18. I would have guessed much older. You know what I'm trying to say? It just plays with you a little bit when you go back and revisit a movie like this.
I also think when you look at one, when Murtaugh is, you know, definitely having issues about aging and, you know, and his beard is all gray. So it's like, okay, was that dye or was he legitimately already graying in his early 40s? And And the fact that I'm looking at my beard right now is like, okay, wait a second. Yes, that kind of seems to play. But no, I think that he definitely had a little bit more of the elder statesman vibe, and Riggs was like kind of in his almost what I would call his prime playing days. But yes, they definitely felt older than they were at the time.
Andrew, this was fun, man. We agreed on Lethal Weapon 2 like 9 months ago. So I guess, are you going to come back? Are you thinking about anything else? What else is on your mind?
Dennis, I'm always thinking, and that list has been growing. And obviously, I would love to come back for Jerry. I know we talked about it. I would say Get Shorty is definitely up there, but I don't know if that's been reserved or if I'm so remiss.
Get Shorty is available, and you have my attention on Get Shorty. Big fan of Get Shorty. Big fan.
Yeah. There are so many that I could get into, and I think we're gonna have to have a sidebar because I don't wanna bore our listeners for it. But yes, I would love to come back. This was just a ton of fun, man. Oh my God, I'm over the moon about it. So thank you. And this was again almost 6 months. Wow, I mean this was incredible.
Man, Ray Bones Barboni is one of my favorite characters of the '90s. Dennis Farina, I am a big fan of Dennis Farina. Anything that guy did, I was all in. I loved him as Jimmy Serrano. So Get Shorty might have to move up the queue, and we'll talk about a couple of others, but you've got my attention on Get Shorty. And as I said earlier, man, everybody's been reaching out to me over the last several months with like movie requests, and I literally had to put together a spreadsheet to track all of it because there's been so many movies that people have asked about, and I want to make sure that I assign it to the right person. So keep the requests coming, people. I'm flattered, and I appreciate everybody listening and having a lot of fun with the show right now. This was great tonight. Andrew, thanks for coming on, and going to be back in a couple weeks with another classic from 1989, actually, David S. Ward's Major League, which only came out like 2 months before Lethal Weapon 2 came out. So going back to 89 with my buddy Jason Thompson, he's a big baseball fan. He's our resident baseball purist. We're going to revisit Ricky Vaughn and the Cleveland Indians, and I have a feeling that we're going to probably talk about a bunch of baseball movies. Do you have any favorites, Andrew, while I have you?
I mean, I would say Major League, I quote Serrano all the damn time. So yes, I would say that's going to be up there. Field of Dreams for its own reasons. Bull Durham, I think when I saw it, I was a little too young, but as I, see it now, amazing movie. But yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned that you won $10 on Lethal Weapon 2, but we didn't reference it in this episode. So quickly, before we wrap, talk to us.
Yeah, so it was pretty hilarious. My friends Debbie Brown and Jody Gelfand in Carpool, we got into a whole argument about how after the hotel pool scene that they kept telling me that, oh, they're at Joe Pesci's house. And I said, no, they're at Murtaugh's house. They're like, no, they're at Pesci's house. I'm like, how much do you want to bet? They're like, $5 each. I'm like, okay, fine. So if I win, you each pay me $5. And if I lose, I then owe you each $5. Done. I said, okay, great. You're going to come over and I'm going to prove it now. So queued up, lo and behold, there is a line in that scene when Riggs says, hey, Raj, where does Trish keep my laundry? Proved everything exactly. Right then and there. And they were like, oh my God, we were wrong. You were right. And I was like, thank you. So I guess my encyclopedic movie memory was there from a very early age. So thank you, Lethal.
I don't want to put them down, but man, that's an easy one. That's an easy $10 for you. I mean, they even bring out the shirt because Leo put the shirt in the dryer by accident, right? And Riggs' shirt got shrunk. And Murtaugh's like, that'll fit Nick. You should give it to Nick or whatever. Yeah, it was totally the Murtaugh house. Absolutely. 1,000%.
So I actually also made money off the movie. So thank you. Thank you, Warner Brothers.
Well, listen, Andrew, this was a lot of fun, man. Thanks for coming on tonight.
Dennis, thank you so much. This was incredible.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back soon. Andrew, have a great night. It's good to see you, man. Thank you.
Dennis, same. Thanks again.